Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rat. And today, finally, I'm playing the interview I did with Noelle McCarthy about her new memoir called Stakes. I've never read Dracula because there's a lot of reference to Dracula in here, but thanks to Noelle, I have done it.
I think Bram Stoker's going to be getting a huge, spike in sales, isn't it, across Aotearoa, because everybody that I know who's talking about the book and saying, I've got to go and read Dracula. Fascinating how some people fix on a fictional, and it's such an interesting fictional kind of story to have fixed on, isn't it?
It is. And so read Noelle's memoir, Stakes. And the good thing is, if you haven't read Dracula, you'll still enjoy the stories that she's telling. But it is helpful to to recognise to try and understand her obsession with the book and the writer.
Yeah, I think she can't help but be entertaining, though, can she? So,
absolutely. And she's a marvellous storyteller and she's a wonderful writer. So I also have been speaking with Elizabeth Smither, talking about wonderful writers. She has a new collection of poems out, and she's such a thoughtful, graceful joy bringer. That doesn't make sense at all, does it?
Yes, no. It does. Joy bringer. I like it.
The sentence is all over the place. But never mind, we will go on. Your book.
My book is for a young adult fiction to add to that trio, and it's Sarah Johnson. It's called Not a Babe, and it is a wonderful feminist earthy, rigorous book about two young women who are surfers in Raglan, and our heroine. It's a coming of age story for her, but discovering yourself and discovering how strong you can be. And terrific read, and highly recommend for young readers.
Set in my Turanga Waiwai, so my heart is in that part of the country.
The landscape is a big part of the book.
Good. Noelle McCarthy first beguiled us as a broadcaster with Radio New Zealand, a real talent for storytelling, and it all went well until it didn't. And then she documented this in her first book, Grand, Becoming My Mother's Daughter. This won the best first book of nonfiction at the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards in 2023. And she was then the writer in residence at the IIML. This tale continues in her new memoir, Stakes, but through a different lens. Her lifelong love of Dracula and all things vampiric. And Noelle, I've already confessed my my appalling lack of, knowing about Dracula. I've just had to find a copy of it in my daughter's room and begin. So you've lured me in.
That is such a win, Maureen. I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be converting a Dracula neophyte.
Well, yes, the fangs are well and truly in, I think. And I'm interested in that. I mean, just as an aside, I, was a teenager in the 60s and I just have no memory of Dracula being a thing. And I was a big reader. But then, according to the foreword in this Penguin Classic, it was the 1970s where there was a sort of a revival, I think, of Dracula and interest in the tale.
I think the copy that you have of the book is Christopher Frayling's foreword.
Yes.
He's an academic.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very interesting foreword because he really links it, doesn't he, to sexual politics in the 1970s and those sorts of social upsets and changes. And Dracula is very much, you know, a book you'd read for that. But the thing that comes to mind for me is the Hammer Horror films. And the Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee vampire, which were big, you know, had that sort of late 70s, 80s aesthetic, which is kind of the peak camp of the vampire, if you like. And he says some really interesting things about those sort of homoerotic subtexts, because, of course, they were subtexts in the novel because Bram Stoker was writing this book. It was published in 1897. So, you know, the end of the 19th century when such things were unspeakable. And yet in the public consciousness, you know, you had that very famous, infamous trial of Oscar Wilde. You know, everybody in London was following that trial for, you know, what were politely termed sort of lewd acts or base acts of perversion. You know, this is very much the realm in which Dracula exists, you know, the realm of forbidden appetites and forbidden passions. So yeah, I'm not a bit surprised that the 70s sort of that Frayling is saying that, you know, that this is a period in which, but I always think that every generation gets the Dracula they need, like gets the vampire they need. You know, for me it was the early 90s, and that's what I talk about in Stakes, you know, my own coming to fantasize about the vampire, coming to be fascinated by the vampire. And I think around then it would have been Francis Ford Coppola's film version of the novel. And he made a lot of how it was going to be an original, you know, it was going to be Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. But actually it took enormous liberties with the book and was better for it in some ways. You know, we loved that film, and Winona Ryder, of course, you know, the woman of my heart. And so this memoir, Stakes, is as much about my sort of teenage pantheon of heroes and heroines as much as the fantasy of the vampire.
Yeah, and juxtaposed, obviously, with growing up in Ireland, with having a mother who was not vampiric, but tempestuous. An ugly drunk at times, all those things that you've already documented in your first book. But you can see the lure of something like this to a girl like you.
You can, can't you? I mean, thank you for saying that. I feel very seen. That's one of the big tensions in the book, I think, Maureen. You know, that strand of fantasy versus reality. And it was a real animating force when I was organizing myself, you know, writing this. I was thinking of all the ways in which teenage me wanted to escape, you know, wanted to escape, not just Cork City, where I grew up, which, you know, in the 80s and 90s, this is pre-Celtic Tiger, you know, it was pretty, it was hard going in lots of ways. You know, Ireland hadn't had that sort of economic and cultural flowering, you know, like it was always there, certainly. But, you know, growing up for me, these were very prosaic sort of realities. And reading Dracula in particular, and the Gothic in general, you know, like I include Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, those great 19th century fantasies, was such a powerful escape for me. And it was something I thirsted after, you know, the glamour, in my head anyway, the glamour of 19th century London, you know, the carriage wheels, the fog on the Thames. Now, of course, like all of that was pretty gritty as well. We know that now. We know that reality of you know, life as a Victorian woman probably wasn't very easy. Unless you were very rich. But for me, growing up in Ireland in the early 90s, I couldn't think of anything more wonderful. And that was very useful to me when I was writing the book, you know, like looking at all the ways in which my actual life disappointed me or confounded me. as opposed to the Gothic, which was this place of refuge and glamour. And I think has functioned as this place of refuge and glamour and intrigue for hundreds of years. You know, I was very aware, I'm not by any means the first writer to be captivated by the Gothic. You know, there's a whole long trail of us, you know, all the way back to Byron, Jane Austen. You know, it is not new. It is not particularly original. But I did want to juxtapose my two lives, if you like. You know, my life in reality, discovering boys, discovering alcohol, discovering the world. And then my life in the Gothic, my life in Dracula and in this book.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because when you were at university, you won a prize for an essay that you did about Dracula, and then you started into a possible PhD, master's, whatever, and did a whole lot of in-depth, very academic research. You would never have realised at that stage that it would come out in this form.
No, and that's the joy of it, I think. You know, it was funny, I was listening to your beautiful introduction and you know, you talked about me as a storyteller at Radio New Zealand. And, you know, when I think of that time, I remember my conception of myself, even though I was very, very, I loved my job and I loved the stimulation of it. But I always thought of myself as a failed academic. You know, I always thought of that thesis and how I had not finished a thesis on the technology of monsters in the Victorian popular Gothic. You know, that was what it was. And that was what I was considering. And I never finished it. And that hung over me. And if you had told me 20 years ago that the most satisfying way or the most, you know, the way I'd be able to finish this story is by writing it as memoir, you know, by writing it personally, I'd have been shocked and maybe kind of horrified because, you know, the idea of the subjective eye for so many historians and writers, you know, academic writers, rigorous academic writers, that don't really bring the eye into it. You know, it's not the done thing. And if they do, it's very controlled. Whereas for stakes, you know, this is the I, you know, it's all about. And I try very hard, and it was very important to me to only give my own experience, you know, especially when I'm talking about sort of political currents, you know, things like the post Me Too. That was very important to me to only speak from my experience and not to speak as an academic or a journalist, or because I'm not an academic and I didn't want to speak as a journalist because that's not what this book is. This book is a lot more intimate. You know, it was the intimacy in Bram Stoker's Dracula, the novel, more than anything else that intoxicated me. You know, you realize very early on, oh, I'm reading these people's diaries. I'm reading their journals. I'm reading their innermost thoughts. And that captivated me. And so there's a lovely sense of satisfaction using the form of memoir. You know, I went back and forth with this book. It was not easy to decide on a form, you know, and I thought I'll novelize it, especially because a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about sex. I'm talking about alcoholism. I am talking about very sort of private, personal, taboo things. And so I thought, you can just write a novel and you can just say, none of that's you. You know? And you can say, that's just a character. You can even call her Noelle if you want to, but you can say it's fiction. And in the end, I couldn't do that. It didn't work. It didn't have the same energy and charge for me, just personally, as I was writing it, unless I wrote from the eye that exists in the world right now.
And it's the way people relate now to memoir, because memoir has sort of expanded so much. You know, people can write about their lives in so many more interesting ways. Oh, maybe they did before, but I think it's, you know, to in my experience, there's so many more interesting and intriguing and challenging ways of writing memoir now. And that's why we, you know, readers get so much out of it.
I think so. I think it is visceral. You know, it is the lived experience. It's the personal, but it's also, as you say, you know, I was thinking about what's In the Dream House by Carmen Machado, is it? I'm mispronouncing that possibly, which was a book that I read early on when I was drafting Stakes. And what that writer does in terms of conceptualizing the eye as a haunted house was so incredibly rich and fruitful and fun. You know, one thing I really wanted to get across is the inventiveness of the Gothic and the way it subverts seriousness, because there are parts of Dracula that are absolutely ridiculous. You know, people are having these absolutely outrageous fantasies and dreams, and they're running around England and Transylvania. You know, it lends itself to fantasy and camp and overstatement and invention, I think. And you're right, you know, memoir thrilled me because it allows you to do this. I thought a lot about Jeanette Winterson as well when I was writing this book. You know, I went back to first, oranges are not the only fruit, which is novelized, but also Why Be Happy When You Can Be Normal. I read that memoir a few times because there was something about the tone of it that is so playful and humorous and wry and has all of those rhythms of the north of England and the language of the north of England, which punctures seriousness so beautifully. So that was really, you know, all the books I keep coming back to were Leslie Jameson's work, you know, they're all memoir. And so it was a soothing thing ultimately to write into that, to say, I want to be part of that tradition. And then, of course, you have to put it out of your head that it'll be published or that anyone will read it. You know, I was saying the other day, it's like everyone read my diary because I gave them my diary. So, you know, not that it's a lot more. I think it's a lot more edited than that and worked on and considered than my diary. I would hate for anyone to read my actual diary. There's not much in it, you know, that's useful to anyone, I think. But that sense of intimacy is important.
Well, it is a gift that a writer gives a reader, because we all come to these books with our own lives and preconceptions and whatever, but we come to find out as much about ourselves as we do about you, don't we?
Absolutely. And I saw that with Grand. You know, I've said this before, but when I did festivals, you know, like Word, people would come up afterwards and they would talk to me, and they would not talk to me about my mother and my life. They would talk to me about their mothers and their lives. And I realized, you know, this is so relatable. We've all got this. You know, we've all been a child of a mother, or, you know, the mother of a child. This is an experience that binds us. We all have families. And they wouldn't just talk about their mothers either. They talk about their fathers, their siblings. You know, I think a lot of the topics I was talking about in relation to intergenerational trauma are so relatable. You know, we've all had those experiences.
We have, and it's in reading and or storytelling, which comes to us in so many different forms, that we start to work, if we want to, work it out for ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like we ask you to do the work on our behalf.
But it's not
okay, Noelle. Spill it all out.
Well, I was doing it. I mean, my answer to that, Maureen, would be I was doing it anyway. You know, it's no difficulty in that way. But, you know, I think about that tension as well between the general and the specific, because, you know, if you look at Jeanette Winterson, Mrs. Winterson, her mother, such a specific individual, you know, this particular mix of piety and aggression, and her sort of fascination with all things to do with the Bible, her proselytizing, you know, all of these incredibly specific traits. But somehow you are able, as you say, to project onto it and to see your own story there. And I think that's the great work, isn't it? You know, like to be specific, but to enable a point of connection. I always wanted that, you know, like from the time I started writing seriously, I know what I've been writing for, and that's connection. you know, that I want to reach out from my experience to you and yours. And I don't know what yours is, but I'm certainly writing for somebody.
It works. Yeah, it definitely works. I don't know how to expand that any further. But yeah, and, you know, your experience with your mother is, as you say, particular. She was a particular person, of course she was. And it's something that you as a mother now see through a different lens as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you were asking about whether you were becoming your mother in the first book, and I think now you realise that, of course, we become our mothers, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yes. That question of inheritance, you know, there is a mystery in Dracula that I never put into words around what makes the vampire what he is. You know, Van Helsing touches on it from time to time and gives explanations, but they're not very convincing. You know, they're a kind of a mishmash of occult sort of stories and legends and stuff he says he's read somewhere. But really, it's mysterious. The vampire is as the vampire is. And for me, that question of inheritance and what have I taken down along the maternal line is about, it requires acceptance. It requires me to accept the past and the nature of the past and the unknowability of my mother. You know, that's what this book is really, I think, about. You know, it's that sort of black box of her experience that I can't get into. You know, and I talk about where she worked, the asylum where she was, the things, the traumas that were part of her life that I wasn't present for. And really, I conclude the impossibility of knowing that. But my work is to, as a person, is to just be in the world with that as my inheritance and live and have a daughter, as you say, you know, be a mother. Mm. And it's in that sort of, there's a beautiful line in that Aldous Harding song, you know, The Barrel, that I listened to a lot when my mom was sick. And it talks about the braid that we are in with our mothers, you know, and the braid of generations and the braid of love. And I think in the writing of this book, I realized that's my favorite context. You know, that's where I live, in that braid of generations. And I remember how much of a shift came in my relationship with my mother when I became a mother. And for other people, it'll be something else. You know, it doesn't always have to be having a child. It's another hinge or another development in your own life that throws that relationship. Sometimes I think it's the parent getting sick, or, you know, that relationship of responsibility changing. And for me, it was becoming a mother, and that shifted our relationship. But I still didn't understand her. You know, I just had a different way of seeing her. And, you know, Stakes, if Grand was about the end of her life, you know, Stakes is really about living.
Yes.
Those of us who are left. Mm. And what happens when you're left with grief and with questions and with that sense of what you've lost and what you need to take forward. Because for me, I think I realized as a teenager, Dracula was also a very honest depiction of grief and emotional pain. You know, even though it's a fantastical story about a monster, the grief in it and the love, it's very real. It's very real and it's very honest. And, you know, again, Bram Stoker is unknowable to me at the distance of years. But, you know, this book is a lot about me trying to understand him, you know, this Victorian man, and I'm separated from him by continents and centuries. But I was trying to understand him as a writer and as a person. And, you know, love is a very powerful theme in his story, too. The love he had for Henry Irving, who was the theatre manager. He was the theatre manager for this great Shakespearean actor who he loved. You know, he loved dearly, perhaps, you know, obsessively. And that was our connection. You know, that was a point of connection anyway that I didn't quite realise, I think, until, you know, sometimes you have to wait until a book is finished before you know what it's about, before you know what you've actually written. So that was a surprise to me, having that connection. And it is a question of legacy and inheritance, because of course he created this monster, Bram Stoker. You know, he died poor. It didn't get great reviews. You know, it wasn't celebrated in its time. But he created this monster that's pretty much this one of the single most successful pieces of intellectual property of the last 200 years. You know, forget your Marvel, forget anything else. He was massively, massively inspired. And there is a sadness there for me that he didn't know that. He didn't know, you know, what his legacy would be.
Well, you have done an extraordinary you have done wonderful work in putting this book together.
Thank you.
I think that people are going to be drawn to Dracula if they haven't, but they're going to learn a great deal about you and about themselves. So thank you, Noelle. The book is called Stakes. It's by Noelle McCarthy and published by Penguin Random House.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Jerry and her best mate, Frida, are surfers, hardcore female athletic talent in a still male-dominated sport, fighting to be taken seriously or just to be left alone to get on with it on their own terms. As if teenage life wasn't complicated enough anyway. In Not a Babe, Sarah Johnson gives us a young heroine finding her strength, making her way and owning her place on the waves and in all aspects of her life. It's a book full of the power of nature and teenage spirit. A great portrait of uncomplicated young women's friendship, which is a tonic to read. It's a pleasure to welcome Sarah to Bookends to chat about it. Tēnā koe.
Thank you very much. Tēnā koe to you too. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a gorgeous cover art. Tell us about that.
Isn't it wonderful? So that was a combination. I had a concept which I explained to the publisher, One Tree House, and they just did an amazing job with it. It took, you know, a bit of fiddling, but so I think Christine Dale of One Tree House actually did the design, but I love it. And it's based on covers by an author called Christopher Brookmeyer. I don't know if you know him. I think he's Scottish. But anyhow, he does these beautiful covers which are matte and single colour and then with the pop-out titles. Yeah, so they were very open to my ideas, which I thought was really nice.
Yeah, cool. So the cover we're talking about's got two women, young women riding waves in spring suits, which is relevant to the story, and beautiful pop-out colourways. It's really vivid and should be easy to spot on the shelves. So are you a surfer, Sarah?
Well, that's an interesting question. So I live in Whangaroa, Raglan, and I have lived here for 23 years, but I only took up surfing 3 years ago. When I started researching and writing the novel, I decided that I needed to learn to surf. I've always been an ocean person, so I didn't really need it for the sense of the immersion in the ocean, but I just felt like I needed to. I've got four boys and they all surf, but I really needed to get to the point, you know, where the youngest was didn't need me anymore in the water. And I could go out independently. And since then, I have become absolutely addicted. I'm still not very good. I'm still a beginner 3 years in. It's quite difficult, I must say, especially when you're learning in your 50s. But it's just been life-changing, to be honest. And now I have to force myself not to surf.
Fantastic.
And get some work done.
To get some work done. That's a great story to hear. I took up stand-up surfing in Scarborough here as an old lady. And I fully understand the 3 years and still a beginner thing. So have you encountered that firsthand yourself in your time, the moronic kind of culture that Jerry and Frida have to put up with?
Yeah, I have, and I have had aspersions cast at whether I should even be in the water. And like I said, I've lived in Raglan a long time, and it's a surf crazy place. It is. It's absolutely, you know, so much of it revolves around surfing, and that's wonderful. But I know I have a lot of female surfing friends who are really good surfers, unlike me, and they face so much aggression
still
in the water.
Still.
And it was like that when I was growing up, because I used to come out to Raglan when I was young, and I remember then you just actually at that stage you didn't really even think about going out surfing if you were a woman. You sat on the beach or you bodyboarded.
Yeah.
Which has changed because there's now masses of female surfers, but there is still that residual opposition from some quarters.
So it's the opposition, you shouldn't be in the water, but there's also that really dumb objectification business, which you have got Frieda and Jerry dealing with. All girls have to face that, not just surfers. But lots of teenage female culture is still kind of complicit with it in some ways, you know, like girls, you know. But so why is girls' agency still heroic or extraordinary in your opinion rather than the norm? Why is it that we need books still to be encouraging this?
Because I do observe that personally. I do. I mean, the objectification of woman, I don't think it's personally improved since when I was young. And sometimes I despair about kind of having grown up on the coattails of that second wave feminism. And it's like, well, where has it got us in terms of that approach to, how women always have to look nice? Or they don't always have to. It's easy to slip into stereotypes, isn't it? But there is that pressure on young women in particular to be very aware of how they look. And it takes energy, doesn't it? It takes life energy to be always thinking, do I look okay? Which you could be diverting into other things.
Indeed.
And so that...
And which Jerry does really effectively in the end. There's a current of grief running through this story. It kind of elevates the girl's dedication to the waves in lots of ways, this grief that the story carries. And it really connects to the power of the ocean, you know. So I think you've captured that in the story really well. To bring that alive for the listener, what I'm talking about there, I wonder whether you could describe the character Mo to the listeners and perhaps tell the story of her barn of surfboards.
She's a fictional character, obviously, as is everybody in the book. But the ocean does take people, and it is very powerful, and it does take surfers. And so Mo is a surfboard glasser, a person who fiberglasses boards, and an artist. And she has this barn out round the Whanga Road, which is the dirt road. It's still dirt between Raglan and Ruapoki, and a beautiful, beautiful landscape and very wild, where the Maunga Karioi comes right down to the sea. So she lives out there, and she has this barn where she keeps the surfboards of surfers who have died. And because often, well, people are very attached to their surfboards, and some surfers keep hordes of surfboards, and then, of course, the family is left with, well, what do we do with these boards, which often defined people's life, and, you know, once they've passed. So she has a shed where she keeps them for people.
I found it, in the context of that landscape, which you deal with really well, I found the idea of a barn of the surfboards of lost surfers a really beautiful image. The surging drama of the surf and the rescue scene at Te Totu Gorge is really well written. I just want to credit you for that. I felt drenched, exhausted, battered, frightened when I was reading it. It's a very powerful, the sea has a real, Moana has a real power in it. Have you experienced the sea when it's grim and remorseless like that?
I haven't so much been in it, but I am by the sea every day. I've swam in it when it's like that. I haven't personally been in a threatening condition, but I have been down. I mean, Tauhara Gorge is a totally wild place anyhow. For people who haven't been there, it's where on the flanks of the Maungakarioi, there's a huge amphitheatre which is carved out of the land and is just open to the ocean. And the waves just absolutely pound in there, and especially on a stormy day. So I've certainly observed it. And having lived by the sea, you know, for decades now, I love to go to the beach in the middle of a storm.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think you've going to the beach and the sea is one thing, being in the Te Toto Gorge and that wild surf is another, and yes. You capture it very well. I guess what struck me was that taking and surviving risk is part of finding your power, right? That's is how kids find their power. But also, I was really struck by how kind of sensible and responsible our main characters were on the whole. So I wanted to ask, in your experience, are Jerry and Frida and Atta representative of youths today?
Oh, certainly the gorgeous youth in Raglan, yes. I can't talk about other places, but they're very special. And so many of them do surf, and they go out in waves, which... you and I would, I don't know, but you might be a really young surfer, but, you know, like 6 foot waves, and they just paddle out. And so I think you have to have that really advanced responsibility, because you have to know how to handle that environment. I mean, my youngest son, who's 14, he paddles out in waves like that without blinking, and it's straight over a rock. And so, yes, yeah, I think we're very lucky. I mean, we're very lucky in this community for many reasons, but we have a wonderful school, which is an area school and goes from year 0 to 13. And it just raises amazing, amazing youth. And they do tend to be really into the community and really active and competent. Yeah, so it's a wonderful place to live.
That's fantastic. So I wondered about the young readers in your life. And how do you use them in helping you shape a story like this?
So this one, because in the past I've written predominantly junior fiction, so I guess as my own children have grown up, my books have grown up with them. But, yeah, it does very much draw on what I've observed. At the school where my children all went and still go, there's a surf academy. And once you get to year 10, you can join the surf academy and you can go surfing every day. So my two oldest boys did that. And so I had a lot of opportunity to observe them and their friends and, you know, what this world is like for young people. And also the exclusion from it, which is in the book, and how... for certain reasons, some young people are excluded from it, and why that might be. And part of the book is about addressing that, you know, the things that make it difficult for some young people to have a go and be part of it.
Yeah, so Jerry and Frida's mission to make it more accessible for women of all shapes and sizes, just all women, really, without having to waste energy thinking about what they look like. Which I think is a great mission. We can't do spoilers in the book, in an interview. So I don't want to talk about how things pan out. But, your observation of the wholesome, great youth of Raglan, I think, is really interesting to me. Do you think we get different qualities of stories from Aotearoa's wild places than from our cities?
I would think definitely. I mean, it's a very different experience growing up in a city, isn't it? I mean, I grew up in a city and I have a nephew. I mean, I can't pretend to be an expert on what it's like to be a young person in a city, but in a place like this, which only has just over 3,000 residents, it's community. It's everything is community, and you can't escape that as a young person. I'm sure it drives them nuts because they probably do want to escape it very much.
But it's a beautiful thing to me to be reading a book about young people where I still feel like I recognise what adolescence looks like, you know, these days. So it's a joy. The book is a joy. I want to finish our interview with a shout out to the excellent school teachers out there. And to say that Sarah Johnson sees you and loves your mahi. Because the teachers in the book are rock solid, aren't they?
They are. And, again, I guess we're just really lucky where I live because it's their school is fabulous and the teachers are fabulous and they just...
They're bit players. They're not big, but they are kind of in the size of the kids' lives. You've got them really proportionate, you know, and they're rock solid for them, you know, and I was impressed by that. I felt like it was just was very natural. So, so teachers, Sarah Johnson sees you, she loves your work. It's just one more thing to like about the book, Not a Babe, which we've been discussing with author Sarah Johnson. It was published late April by One Tree House and it's available in bookstores and online.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
The Frog. Once I followed a frog down steps to the garden, to a pond. On each step he hopped, then paused to catch what I thought was his breath. One hop, pause, one step. Down we went in the wet night. Light rain was washing his mottled skin. A large, confident frog, a human. Magic in our collaboration. Woman and frog, a distant pond, reached by plodding and breathing and by companionableness.
Elizabeth Smither reading from her latest collection of poems, called The Interview Rose. Elizabeth, of course, is so well known for having written novels, short stories, poetry collections, from being the Tamata Poet Laureate between 2001 and 2003, and for many awards, including the Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement. I last spoke with Elizabeth about her exquisite collection of novellas, Angel Train. And this new collection shows that your devotion to writing is undimmed, Elizabeth, and your joy in capturing moments and stories and memories is still as sharp as ever.
Yes, I still love writing, Maureen. I do hear sometimes writers say, I don't think I've got anything more in me to say, or I don't think I can write a novel now, but I feel I want to keep going faster and faster, like a train or something. Perhaps I'm going to go off the rails. But I do enjoy writing very much. I feel very alive when I'm writing.
Yeah, I can imagine that, because it's something that age... you know, shouldn't really affect in some ways, unless, as you say, you do go off the rails. But even that could be interesting.
Of course.
To document.
You'd find yourself in a new place, wouldn't you?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because, you know, what excited you before should surely still excite you now.
Yes, and I think you find new subjects and your writing never quite stays the same. You add perhaps different qualities and you lose some virtues you had when you were younger, but there's still enough there to produce poetry, I think.
And poems, I was just talking to Owen Marshall about his poetry and he says the interesting thing for him is that he can't sit down and conjure up a poem. They come to him unbidden, as it were. Is it like that for you?
It's sort of like that, but I actually write to a, I have a sort of schedule now, and on Sundays I have a poetry writing session, and I usually sit on the bed surrounded by pillows and poetry box, and I always like to read poems, you know, poems that I love or new poems, and then I start writing, and I usually write about five poems, probably two of which I'll probably keep when I come to type them all up again. But I love writing in longhand, and I often have an idea of a subject, but I'm not really thinking about it until I put the pen on the page, and then I sort of go galloping off writing. I don't even know whether it will have four line stanzas or two or three or one big stanza of 10 lines. I don't know. That sort of comes when I'm actually working on it.
Yeah, so you don't think, you sit down and think, I'll write a villanelle or I'll knock out a sonnet.
No. But I think, I actually think that I would not like to wait until I'm inspired, as people say they do. More like Robert Louis Stevenson, who said it's sort of, I think, 1% inspiration and 99% work. And I sort of go by that method, really. I think if you, it's perhaps like practicing the piano or being a piano player or a concert pianist. If you stopped practicing, you would lose some facility, I think, probably. Anyway, that's the way I think about it. And I like to keep active, but I wouldn't like to write a poem every day. Once a week, having a session is a good, works well for me.
Like that. I suppose if it's inclement, you might be in the bed, not just on it.
Oh yes, and even with a hot water bottle and a cup of tea,
of course,
or a glass of wine sometimes too.
Yes. Yeah, I guess every writer has works out what is most productive for them, and if that's your way of doing it, why would you not keep it going?
That's right. I think I read the other day that Matisse used to draw in bed. You know, when he was old, he used to sit up in bed and draw. But a bed is a very comfortable place. And but when I go to the computer, I'm typing stuff up and, you know, putting it in order and revising. Yes, I wouldn't like to suggest that when I write something, it comes out perfectly. Very often when I'm writing quite quickly, I know I haven't got the right word, and I'll write a question mark under the word or write a better word in brackets, and I know I've got to go back and find a better word, but I want to sweep on through the poem, you know, till I get to the end of it, and then there'll be a tightening in the punctuation and things like that.
Do you enjoy that process?
Sort of, yes. I think I've enjoyed it more as I got older. You know, trying to find the closest word that you want, and but sometimes in the rush of writing, you know, you haven't got that word yet. But yes, it is quite enjoyable, and I like the tightening of a poem too.
Mm. Mm. When you know, obviously, when you're writing your poems, you're not thinking of a collection as a whole, are you? You're thinking poem.
No, and it's funny how they come together. Elizabeth Caffin always puts my poems in order for me. She has an unfailing sense of how they go, and you know, she'll send me the order or phone it over to me, and she'll say frog, and I think, frog, why is she putting the frog poem first? And then when I read it, it's perfect. She's got it right. And I don't have that ability. I have the ability to write, you know, to put the poem in order, but I don't see the best sequence for them. So I'm always grateful to her for doing that for me.
Does it surprise you often how she's found the links and the...
Yes, it does. And I know there's a lot of editors, but her ability... This sort of arranging is very rare. A lot of people can't do it, and I think the majority of people wouldn't be able to do it. You have to have a very fine sense of connection, and I can't see the connection. They're not obvious, you know, but she knows how to do it, so I'm terribly grateful to her.
And it's always interesting as a reader to, it's not that you're trying to work out, it's not a puzzle that you have to work out why one poem leads to another, but it's always satisfying when you look back and see how the collection has been arranged.
Yes, and I mean, if you're not good at putting it together, you put a collection together and it seems to sag in the middle or something, and you're trying to avoid that. Obviously, if you've got a lot of poems from Jane Austen, they're going to go together in a little group, and the annual ones go together, and some on music and so forth. There are suggestions of order, but it's quite skillful the way it can be put together. So it reads as a, you know, as a collection, but also very often when you get a collection of poems, you just open it and read a short one somewhere, and then you might go back and read a few more. But if you want to, you can read it right through from beginning to end.
Yes, that's the wonder of a collection of either short stories or poems, that you can do that wonderful thing of just opening the book up and reading what is there on the page.
That's right. And they are sort of little complete things in themselves.
I was fascinated to see your granddaughter Ruby appear in some of these poems, because I remember that lovely book you put out. I think it was called Ruby Slippers, was it?
Ruby Dooby Doo.
Yes.
Yes, fascinating. She likes writing too, and she's very musical. It's quite fun writing poems for young people, and yes, watching her grow up, and she enjoys it. I don't make anything much of it, but sometimes I show her a poem I've written. But yes, it's fascinating. I like the one about Ruby approaching a cello. We were at a Baroque concert, and at half time, some of the players came down and sat among the audience, and I watched her go up and talk to the player of the cello, and then she was holding the bow and asking questions. And it's a lovely thing to do, because you can't tell what in a child's life will become an influence. I mean, she might one day play the cello, I don't know, but I know she's interested in music. But it was lovely also that the cellist was so receptive to the young people.
Yes, and to actually be able to touch an instrument, because often you feel very nervous about putting a hand on somebody's instrument.
That's right. And yeah. I heard something on the radio some time ago where a person who was a cellist and had been a cellist in an orchestra for many years said the cello actually hurt his body, because it's quite a, you know, to play it, you're sort of in a crouched over position, aren't you?
So
there's stress of playing instruments too.
Huge. And there's a lovely poem about you going to choose a book for Ruby and how you want her to stay. You don't want her, well, you can't stop her, but you want her to stay in that stage for as long as possible.
That's right. They go through lovely stages. I think there's an age about 10 where they're really lovely. They've got really good brains and they're articulate and everything. And then later on, they'll turn into teenagers and, you know, they just grunt or something, especially male teenagers. You can hardly get a sentence out of them. They just grunt and things like that. And they're sort of morose and they're full of emotion. But the 10-year-old is a beautiful stage. I think it's around 10, where you can have wonderful conversations with them. I was talking to one of my grandsons the other day, and he was telling me about a maths test he'd done, you know. But give him another 3 or 4 years, he won't be confiding in me like that.
No, he won't. He'll be inaccessible until you get them back, usually.
That's right. Yes.
And they emerge again.
They do. They're grumpy. And then later on they return and they're very loving.
Yes, exactly. Elizabeth, this is such a warm and satisfying collection of poems. And I'd love you to read us one to end the interview. Another one, shall I say?
Just putting on my glasses. This one's about Mark Doty. He's a famous American poet. And we were at a conference, a festival in Aubra, and it's just about him, what he does with the football. Mark Doty, a footnote. Walking between venues in Aubra to attend the next reading or panel, a boy kicks a football in Mark Doty's path. just a poet walking, one of those removed from the world, a floater. But look, he has scooped up the ball on the curve of his foot, cradles it like a bird fallen from a tree, rolls it up to chest height, then over his shoulder, his other foot hooks to kick it back to two astonished boys. A poet who could play for Chelsea or Real Madrid, earn a fee far greater than any poet, but greatest of all is the way he goes on chatting to the other poets, his head lowered, as modestly he sets the world back in place.
What a very appropriate poem for this time with the World Cup about.
I'd forgotten about that.
To kick off.
Yes, because you do think of poets as rather dopey and, and you know, and not always particularly good-looking. He's a very good-looking poet. But, you know, just those little boys are absolutely astonished what he did, and he just went nonchalantly on walking.
I can just see it. Yeah,
I think the opinion of the little boys would be quite elevated after that.
Indeed, and they'd be astonished to know what he can do with words, his agility with words. Thank you for your time, and thank you for giving us such wonderful poems. The Interview Rose by Elizabeth Smither is published by Auckland University Press. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.